Welcome, everyone, to the Penn Primary Care Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kendall Williams. So we've all managed it. Most of us have had it. And I imagine a large proportion of us don't fully understand it. And that is back pain. It is the second most common reason patients present to physicians in this country. About 80% of people will have a severe back pain episode in their lifetime. So it's very common. And I don't know that any of us really know much about it. So I trained in internal medicine. I have some sense of what is also learned in family medicine programs. I think we all learn management algorithms for managing back pain, and we follow those in our practice. But, you know, I'm not sure we really understand what's going on here. So I wanted to invite some folks on to talk about that. So here with me today is Dr. John Yoon. John is an assistant professor of neurosurgery at Penn, and he's the director of the Minimally Invasive Spine Center. John, thanks for coming.
Thanks for inviting, Kendall.
I also have from the other side of the spine paradigm, from the orthopedic side, is Dr. David Casper. Dave is an assistant professor of orthopedics at Penn. He is the director of clinical research in spine surgery at Penn. Dave, thanks for coming.
Kendall, thanks so much for the opportunity. I appreciate you taking this on and letting us get a chance to shed a little light on a difficult topic.
Well, I really appreciate you having me. And this is somewhat selfish. I've been struggling with back pain this whole week. I've been walking around very stiffly. I see patients late on Monday evenings. And I had one patient there who's an emeritus professor at Penn. And we finished up the visit and I couldn't get out of the chair. And he was so kind, this late 80s-year-old gentleman coming over to me to help me get out of the chair. So I'm struggling with this right now. It's very personal. I actually want to delve into the anatomy here first and just understand the spine itself. And we can talk about the cervical spine, by the way, and the lumbar spine. But obviously, the way I explain this to people is you got vertebrae stacked on top of each other. The spinal cord runs between them in a protected tunnel, if you will. And you have these discs that sort of cushion everything and allow mobility. But, well, let me let you guys talk about the anatomy of the spine, because you've actually held it in your hand and you know exactly what these things feel like. How do you explain the anatomy of spine, John?
Spine, I think, is a fascinating sort of a construct. If you imagine that, if you look back, I'm just going off the little bit of rail here. If you look at the whales, for example, horses, the primates, and then the orangutans and monkeys, everybody, and then humans, we all have vertebrae and they all have spinal cord as housed. So it's sort of a cross species that, you know, the whales just have a little bit bigger than us, but they have a cervical spine, they have a thoracic spine, lumbar spine, the sacrum. And then we all have a sort of basic neural structure that runs through. So it's a very fascinating sort of a structure that houses the nerves inside and has the discs. And it has the bony structure to support the rest of the body. So if you imagine there's a cervical spine and lumbar spine, thoracic spine runs through the entire sort of spans the head, the chest, thoracic, into the legs. So it's a really big, broad anatomic structure that all of us have. And I think the humans, unlike the whales and the dolphins, they don't really have a gravity. They live in the water. The monkeys get this too, interestingly, the gravity. So once the vertebrae were developed and when we were swimming in the ocean and it became bipedal, so upright, there's a whole gravity effect that happens where all of us, we all be walking upright and then the gravity takes a toll onto neck and the thoracic spine, lumbar spine, and that's how the diseases form. So the simple way to really think about the cervical spine, thoracic is breakfast, lunch, dinner. So breakfast, 7 o'clock. So there's 7 cervical spine, 12 thoracic spine at lunch. And then the 5, I have a pretty early dinner. So 5 lumbar spine, 5 sacrum, and the coccyx anywhere from 3 to 5 fused vertebrae. And there's a lot of joints. Unlike these shoulders, joints, and Dave probably have a better expert at this, but all the other joints in the body are just one joints, right? The shoulder joints, hip joint, knee joints, ankle has a little bit more, the hand has a little bit more, but spine has tons of joints. Each level has 2 joints on the side, and they're all connected to the level above and below. So what that means is that it has a lot of flexibility. So it allows you to move in all different directions, but it also means that it can break at all those spots. So if your spine breaks, It could be at the level adjacent to it, or it could be a level below. Your nerves are also running in there. So there's a lot of complexity of anatomy, which makes the disease difficult to diagnose and also difficult to treat. And I'll let Dave kind of speak to that.
I think that's spot on. And truly, the spine's goal is to keep the head over the pelvis. And I'm sure everyone's heard the term scoliosis before. And really, all that implies is a curvature of the spine. But oftentimes, we can have patients that have scoliosis. And as long as their head remains over their pelvis, oftentimes, patients do quite well with that. And the issue is, as things start to shift or move, and the head all of a sudden becomes either it's forward, sideways, you begin to operate at a mechanical disadvantage. And that's where patients start to run into issues with back pain and other sorts of problems. And the other goal of the spine is really is a conveyance of the neural elements, meaning transmitting the neural elements from the brain out to the extremities.
So let's go into a little bit that can go wrong. John mentioned gravity is against us, as it is with knee joints and hip joints as well. But so you have the vertebrae, hard vertebrae stacked on top of each other. And attached to the processes in the back, the protrude out posteriorly, you have the ligaments and muscles. So some amount of back pain that folks have is akin to just spraining an ankle, right? You can sprain your back. I drove to Florida a couple of years ago, and I came back and I was happy that I got out of the car. My back didn't feel too badly. And then I was cleaning out the car and I felt it, my back just give way as I was trying to pick up a candy wrapper or something my kids had left on the floor. And it almost felt like an ankle sprain. So, and it lasted a few days. I never had neurologic symptoms and it went away. And I had thought that was ligamentous. But how much of that are you seeing? Before we get into the bones and discs, what about just the outer muscles and ligaments?
Kendall, I think probably the most common and oftentimes what a lot of our primary care providers are seeing, physical therapists. And I think what's important to understand at the back, similar to your experience, is it's very good at accommodating at the time of injury. Meaning oftentimes patients will push themselves, they'll lift heavy furniture, they'll engage in an activity. And over a prolonged period of time, they feel fine. But then maybe later on that night or the next day, they're miserable and their back's bothering them and they can't necessarily put their finger on it. But what I will tell you, similar to you picking up the candy bar, is really it's the back gets to a tipping point where it says enough's enough. And typically I find that's exactly what you said. It's often the soft tissues, it's the muscles, it's the ligamentous attachments. It's more of those surrounding soft tissue structures that are really the culprit of that kind of pain.
Yeah. And then I think that's why the musculoskeletal ligaments sprain is hard to diagnose. There's no imaging that we can say and say, oh, that muscle looks like it's sprained. And so 70% of the Americans have some type of back pain in their lifetime. A lot of those patients do not require surgical intervention to treat that because most of that is from the muscular pull or the ligamental sprain. And so I'll say the 90%, 99% of the back pain is really caused by that. And treatment for that is just a conservative therapy, rest, NSAIDs, a physical therapy, and stretching and rest. And then they'll self-resolve. There may be 10%, 5% of those back pain is due to the discs, nerves, or a fracture that requires a real deep dive. And that's when the MRIs and further workups, x-rays is needed.
Yeah, I think they usually want us to give about 12 weeks of conservative management before we even think about MRIs, as long as there's no weakness and other things that we'll get into. So let's kind of go in a little bit further into the spine and talk about the discs themselves. And I think we're also starting broad in the sense that what we've talked about so far, ligaments and muscles, can happen to anybody, right? And at any age. And disc disease can happen at any age, right? But does, because of the effects of gravity, John, you mentioned, does occur more often with age. But can we just drill down on the anatomy of a disc, what goes wrong with a disc and so forth?
Yeah. So if you look at it from the sort of basic anatomic of the disc is, you know, I tell these patients quite a bit, Dr. Scholes, you know, it's a jelly inside. So there's a nucleus pulposus, which is mostly water. And it's got structures that kind of hold onto the water in the middle. And that's the soft part. And that's the nucleus pulposus. And then surrounding that is the annulus fibrous, which is a type of collagen that is interlaced. So that it contains this jelly inside this fibrous tissue. And we have it at every level of the bone. So between the cervical spine, C4-5, for example, we named the discs based on the where they're adjacent to. So between the C4 bone and C5 bone, there's a disc. And then below that, the same thing. So if you imagine that you're going to be walking around, maybe running outside, every time you run or walk and you hit your foot on the concrete surface, that shock that goes through the impact on your feet gets transmitted all the way up to your spine, right? And the role of the disc is to absorb that shock so that when you're walking, that all that shock doesn't go directly to the bone and fracture it, or maybe it goes to the nerves and it injures a nerve. So disc is really like a suspension in the car, or it's something that, shock absorber, exactly. So that every time you take a pound onto the surface, you don't go into a neurological injury. But they take the pounding so that it can be injured, and that's when people get nerve impingement from it or other diseases.
If I were to pick up a disc and put it in my hand, it wouldn't feel like one of those little soft stress balls, people. That's too soft, right? It's harder than that, right? But not too hard. How would you compare it?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I ever held a normal disc. You know, usually the ones that we are operating on is a diseased disc. And when the disc becomes diseased, it becomes more like a shrimp meat. It's not a fully well-hydrated tissue. It looks like a kind of sort of like a dried sort of a white meat. But we do see the difference between the older patients and younger patients. Younger patients, when we operate and then they have a herniated disc, theirs look like it's a little bit more well hydrated. It's a little bit more plump. But yeah, I don't know how it would feel to feel the normal disc between my hands. But
any thoughts there, Dave?
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to one of my partners here. Dr. Harvey Smith is probably one of the foremost experts on disc pathology. He recently had a publication in Science about 3 weeks ago on a biologic disc patch. But he has a lot of basic science research into disc pathology and biomechanics if anyone wants to do a deep dive. But I will tell you, when I'm trying to talk about discs and disc pathology to patients in clinic, I use the crude example of a jelly donut. When patients are younger, typically they have a very robust jelly donut. They have a lot of jelly in there, and that's really the nucleus pulposus. And the reason that younger patients often are the ones that have big disc herniations is the fact that they have this gelatinous material which can herniate out. And then as we age, the morphology of the disc changes, and oftentimes that jelly turns into more donut. So as we get older, our donut starts to squish down more, the jelly fades away, and it just turns into more and more donut-type material. So really that aging process is really what takes away the viscosity of the disc that John was talking about and kind of causes the transmission of forces through the spine to vary as we age.
So young people can have pathologies of their discs, right? I mean, there's a couple famous athletes recently, you know, Ben Simmons, who played for the Sixers, had some back issues. I think they were disc related. So in terms of where this sits, right, it sits between the vertebrae, but it does have a little bit of squishiness to it. So it can herniate out, right, and put pressure on the nerve root, which is coming out between the vertebrae as well. And we call that a radiculopathy. And that can happen at any age, right?
That's exactly right, Kendall. Oftentimes we do see it in those younger patients, however, just because the herniated material actually is typically more of that viscous type material. So if someone has a nice gelatinous nucleus, what ends up happening is typically it stems from intra-abdominal pressure, increased hoop stresses across the disc. They get a tear in that outer annulus or that outer donut, and then they squeeze some of that jelly or nucleus pulposus out. And then by that putting pressure on a nerve root, you get an inflammatory reaction, which causes that kind of searing leg pain. Typically, those don't cause back pain, although occasionally they can. Really, it's more of a radicular leg pain transmitted in the dermatome of which the nerve it affects.
And you guys will operate on those patients. My impression is it can be a simpler problem to solve with not a large surgery. And I see it's not unusual that one of these athletes or one of my patients gets operated on maybe earlier than the typical course. John, maybe you can speak to that.
There was a good study that looked at this, randomized control study, that looked at how do you treat the herniated disc the first time herniated disc? Do you do a conservative therapy or do you go to the surgery? Basically, the conclusion is that it's okay to try the conservative therapy, but you need to have a sort of an observation. They can be lost to follow-up, meaning that they got to do a proper monthly visit, make sure they're not getting any weaker, but they're getting the physical therapy, NSAIDs, to closely monitor their neurological function. So what I typically do with the patients that are coming in, they have clearly a symptom of a radiculopathy, but they haven't tried a conservative therapy for at least 6 weeks, but I'm okay with extending that to 12 weeks. As long as they're a reasonable person of they can follow up and they have support at home, they can get the physical therapy, then I'll try the conservative therapy. Now, the exceptions are that if they have a weakness, so if they have if it's L5 radiculopathy, then that corresponds to the tibialis anterior, which dorsiflexes the legs and this ankle, and then also extensor hallucis longus, which dorsiflexes the big toe. If there's a clear correlation to the disc herniation to those muscle groups that are weak, then I'll offer surgery up front, because in those cases, the nerves do three things. They're very simple. They do the pain, they do power, and they do numbness and tingling. So if they have just a pain and numbness, I'm okay with trying the conservative therapy and letting their body sort of heal itself. But if it starts to affect the power, if they have an asymmetric motor exam, then I'm more concerned that, okay, this is something that is affecting all three functions of the nerve. And by taking the chance of conservative therapy and delaying the surgery, that person may do worse in the long run. So that's how I practice. But if they have reasonable motor exam and they haven't tried the conservative therapy, herniated disc can resolve by themselves. And that's what the randomized control studies do show.
Yeah. And when they resolve by themselves, John, is it that the disc kind of shifts back into place, the herniation resolves, or is it that the body just accommodates to this thing pressing on it, the nerve accommodates?
Yeah. So there's no exact timeline how long that takes. But if you do image someone after their symptoms have resolved, in about 3 months or so, the disc can shrink back. So maybe it was 7-8 millimeters, it could half in size. And then if you do it again in another 3 months, it could completely go away. Because those herniated discs, they don't have any blood supply. So eventually, nucleus pulposus can just dissolve by themselves. Now, again, everyone's biology is different. Some people have these chronic disc herniations that become calcified and they could harden and they may not change in size. But I'll say that most people, young person, if they have a herniated disc, their symptoms resolve and they repeat the imaging in about 3 months, most of those disc herniations are gone.
Dave, do you want to jump in with anything here?
Yeah, I think John's spot on. Usually I tell patients if I see them in the acute period, meaning they've herniated within the past week, I tell them that 80% of those patients typically get better without any type of surgery. But stuff, oftentimes we might treat patients a little bit differently than we treat ourselves. You know, if I was miserable with a radiculopathy, it'd be hard for me to wait 6 weeks. You know, if I couldn't work, if I couldn't operate, that'd be a tough thing to put up with. We base a lot of our evidence on something called the SPORT trial. And that was kind of what I think John was alluding to. I think it's very reasonable if someone has pretty miserable pain within a couple of weeks, I'll offer them a follow-up with one of our injection specialists to see if they'd like to try a steroid injection. Oftentimes that can decrease the inflammation. If they don't have inflammation, oftentimes they don't have pain. But I think it's often tough to counsel those patients that are absolutely miserable right after it happens that, hey, you know, 80% of these get better on their own. But I'm in agreement with John. Usually, you know, if they've failed conservative treatment at around that 6 week mark, I think it's very reasonable to offer surgery.
You know, if I remember that trial, at least what's taught to us, almost everybody was better at 6 months, but the folks who got surgery were better quicker. And if that becomes a priority, then surgery becomes an option, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Can I ask the two of you, because you're the people to ask, what do you actually do during the surgery and how big a deal is it? John, it's posterior, right? It's a posterior approach or is it anterior?
Yeah, there's multiple ways to get at the disc. Now there's anterior approach, lateral approach, the posterior approach. So many different way to do it. And then also from the posterior approach, you can do it through a small tube with a microscope, or you can make a midline incision, open up the nerves, or you can do it through the endoscope. So there's a many different approach to take the disc out. And my preferred way to do it, I feel passionate about minimally invasive spine surgery. The whole goal of the MIS is get the job done without destroying everything on the way, right? It's kind of like sniper options. If you have a bad guy, just take out the bad guy, but don't destroy the buildings. So one way to take the disc out And let's say if you have a single level herniated disc on one side. So again, the spine has two sides and it's got multiple levels. But if you have a one-sided problem and a one-level problem, minimally invasive option is a very good option where you don't have to open up both sides. You can really target that one level that's herniated out. And typically, those patients tend to be younger because they have no other disease at the other levels. And as Dave said, those people tend to have a very big disc herniation that's very obvious. So in those patients at one level disease with unilateral symptoms, they respond very well to a minimally invasive option. Now, there's a many different definition of what is MIS. And so there's two different options in my mind. There's a tubular approach where you make an incision off to the side that you're operating on, and you insert these circular metal tubes that dilates the tissue out of the way. So you don't cut any muscles, but you displace them. And then you can do your bony work where you're coming from the back of the spine. So you have a skin, you have a muscle, you have a bone and the nerves, and then the disc is below the nerve. So you have to sort of go through all this anatomy to get to the disc. And then you take the disc out. And then by the time you pull out the tube, all the muscles sort of fall back into place and you close. That's one way. There's a tubular microdiscectomy, which has been around for about 20 years. And that's a very good option. The other option now that's been more popular is endoscopic approaches where you do exactly the same thing. You put a small tube, but if you put an even smaller tube, and then instead of using the microscope, we use it's kind of like a laparoscopic, very similar. We call it endoscope because you're not inside a body cavity. You actually push the water out and you can achieve the same sort of, you do the exactly the same. You can drill the bone, move the nerve out of the way, pull out the disc. So in my mind, I think those two are some of the discectomy options that are minimally invasive.
And when you remove the disc, you're just removing the herniated portion, right?
Yeah, you're removing not the entire disc, but you're just removing the portion that has come out. Now, a lot of them it's rare to have a completely sequestered disc fragment. Usually the disc fragment has some origin inside the disc space. So what we typically do is we identify that, remove that piece of disc that's outside the bounds of the disc, but then you often have to go inside the disc to make sure there's no tail that you're missing.
Dave, you may know this more, but you know, I was talking with one of your colleagues about cartilage surgeries in the knee. And you know, if you remove too much cartilage, his point was, if you have a meniscal injury, you remove cartilage, you really kind of accelerate the loss of cartilage. And so you end up with OA or degenerative arthritis earlier and so forth. Do you have that similar phenomenon in the spine as well? If you trim too much of the disc, that you may accelerate arthritis in that area?
Absolutely right. I think part of it too, unfortunately, is that once you herniate a disc and you disrupt the annulus or that outer portion, the way in which force is transmitted through the disc is no longer the same. So we know that whether or not we do surgery on a herniated disc or we treat it conservatively, those patients are set up for more arthritic changes at that disc level at an earlier age. So unfortunately, once a disc has herniated, you're probably a setup for some early stage arthritis at that particular level.
We had referenced this, John, just to kind of put a summary on this herniated disc discussion. The symptoms are going to be sciatica, radiculopathy, all of these words that we use that transmit that nerve impingement down the leg. John, you had mentioned it's usually L4, L5 or L5, S1 are the vulnerable areas. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the most common levels in the low back. That's sort of the transition level from the lumbar spine to the sacrum. So if you imagine that at each transition level, the cervical to thoracic, thoracic to lumbar, lumbar to sacrum, those transition levels do have a little bit more stress because if you image someone that flexes forward and extend up, most of the motion is between L4 and S1. And the cervical spine, the cervical thoracic junction, then thoracic lumbar junction in T10 to L2. So those are the levels with the most motion. And we assume that that's probably where a lot of the forces are applied. So most people would herniate between L4-5 and L5-S1.
So you can have herniation of the disc, but over time, you do get degeneration of the disc, right? So And this is just an age thing. Like everything we've been talking about so far could have happened to a 24-year-old or an 86-year-old disc herniation. But part of the effect of gravity that John had said, you get this loss of disc height, right? You get loss of disc sort of resilience, I suppose. It changes in character, becomes more shrimp meat-like. And that in itself can cause pain, even if it's not moving around, right?
Yeah. No one has really proven this, but I think it's really all of us lose elasticity as we get older. So we all get stiff. It happens in your skin. It happens to our joints. So as we age, I think part of aging is probably losing elastin in our vessels, right? Yeah, we get more hypertensive because our vessel walls become more stiff. We get wrinkles because, you know, our skin becomes more flabby. And the same thing happens to the joints and then the discs. So we lose the water content. So it's true that all of us get shorter, right? We get shorter as we get older. And we're actually the tallest in the morning. So when you lay down at night, so then you wait, you stand up, your discs actually, your disc is distracted, right? So when you stand up in the morning, you're a little bit taller. By the time right now, as we're recording at 6:30, we're going to be a little bit shorter because that much gravity has done a toll on our body. So this happens, you know, so it's every day. There's a cycle of gravity and that's working on your body. So yes, disc shrinks, even if it doesn't herniate, that you have less material to absorb the shocks. And then that can lead to a further degeneration and more back pain.
Is the disc itself painful, Dave? Does the disc itself have nerves?
It's a great question, Kendall. And I think what is difficult for us and kind of what we touched on with back pain earlier is that the answer is it can be. And the difficult thing is that two discs can look exactly the same on an MRI, an X-ray, and CT scan. And in one patient, it can be very painful, and in another patient, it might not be. And I think our understanding of essentially discogenic back pain or pain in the back that stems from the disc probably isn't where it should be. And so those are the patients oftentimes, I'd like to get your thoughts, John, that we can have some frustration with, and that we're really trying to tease out what's the culprit of their symptoms. Is it the muscle? Is it the ligament? Is it the facet joints in the back? And those are two additional joints that oftentimes can be symptomatic and cause back pain. Or is it the disc? And unfortunately, we don't necessarily have great diagnostic tools for some of those. And I can tell you, we'll look at X-rays all day of patients that have just terrible discogenic looking disease. They have degenerative disc disease. Their discs are collapsed. And they're totally asymptomatic in relation to that. So I think long answer is that it can be a culprit of back pain and it can be a culprit of other symptoms, but we have to be critical in terms of how we work that up.
You mentioned the facet joints, and I'm kind of doing a little tour through the anatomy, and we've been going through the disc so far because I think that's a lot of what we see, probably, or at least that's maybe a lot of what we think we see. But you mentioned the facet joints. There's, as the disc degenerates, I would imagine you get some more bony friction as well that can cause, you know, similar to what you might see in the knee or the hip, where that causes inflammation and pain. Is that right, Dave?
Very true. And I think, you know, your analogy that you used earlier in relation to cartilage in the knee, oftentimes I'll try and make a similar comparison in that, you know, you actually have three spaces or compartments in your knee. You have your patellofemoral joint, you have your medial compartment and lateral compartment. So similar to each disc level, you have a disc in the front and then you have two facet joints in the back. So when we're talking about taking care of a problem at one particular level, someone can have significant arthritis in their right-sided L4-5 facet joint, and maybe the other two areas are pristine, or perhaps they have significant disc problems, but their facet joints are fine. And because of that, it's exceedingly varied in terms of the treatment that we do for it. But you can certainly have someone that has a unilateral facet joint that's arthritic and inflamed and painful, and that can be the culprit of their symptoms.
And then the facet joints also have what's called synovium, which is basically lubricant. And just like the synovium joint fluid in the knees, we have it between the spine. So it's contained in the capsule. And then the spine joints are lubricated by the synovium. But just like the discs, they do wear out over time. So when they wear out, that's when the joint surfaces can become bone on bone and they can cause a lot of back pain in the joints.
Does facet joint pain present differently than, say, disc disease itself? I mean, it is most posterior, right? So, but I don't know if you can tell the difference.
Yeah, I would say that it can. The difficulty with it is that oftentimes when patients are describing their symptoms, we have to be very focused in terms of not only our history, but also the physical exam maneuvers. I will tell you, for me, though, the best diagnostic tool for facet joint mediated pain is typically injection strategies. I find that oftentimes you'll hear a story, you'll look at imaging, you'll say, yep, we have what looks to me like a pretty arthritic facet joint. I'm not sure if it's the disc. I'm not sure if it's maybe the facet joint. Let's try an injection in that facet joint. And oftentimes, if patients get significant relief with that, that can be very much diagnostic.
Yeah. And then I think it's really hard to tell, you know, discogenic back pain versus a facetogenic back pain. I think both of them, if you have a load-bearing maneuver, so like if you're sitting down or laying down, they both of them do get better. So when they stand up, that both of them do tend to get worse. Specifically for the facetogenic pain, tends to have a little bit more pain elicited by flexion extension. So if you stress that joint or lateral bending, so if you ask the patient, okay, does it hurt when you try to pick up stuff from the ground or you turn your body, does that hurt more? Then it points a little bit more towards a facetogenic pain. But again, so much of that facetogenic arthropathy and discogenic pain, they're so comorbid. It's hard to tease out just based on the clinical history alone.
We're just going over pathology first before we get to surgeries and treatments. The other pathology I just wanted to talk about is spinal stenosis, right? So this is where the spinal canal itself gets narrowed. I had always thought of this as if a disc shifts itself can cause spinal stenosis. But I always thought of this as sort of a chronically arthritic back that was causing bony changes, I suppose, that were causing now compression on the spinal cord. Am I thinking about that right?
Yeah, Kendall, I think very spot on. Stenosis simply means narrowing, right? We use it and we'll read it in our radiology reports and it seems complex, but stenosis just means narrowing. And you can have stenosis at different areas or locations within the spine. And oftentimes it is caused by, as you said, arthritic changes where we'll develop bone spurs or hypertrophied ligamentum or other structures that are pushing on the neural anatomy. And so stenosis in and of itself isn't necessarily a problem, but it's when stenosis leads to inflammation, pressure on neural elements that then become symptomatic. So again, we can see patients that really have significant stenosis on MRIs, but might otherwise be asymptomatic because it's accrued over a very long period of time and they've done a good job adapting to it. Whereas if someone has an acute disc herniation and they develop lateral recess stenosis in that immediate moment, they're going to be very symptomatic from it.
Yeah, and then the stenosis oftentimes, unlike the herniated disc, truly herniated disc that's symptomatic, the stenosis kind of diffuse because the people accrue it all the time, over time, and it doesn't really happen acutely. You know, not, unlike the herniated disc where people can, most of the time they can recall, okay, I was picking up an object, oh my God, now I have a pain. Stenosis pain just kind of happens gradually over time. So typically in the lumbar spine, it can cause neurogenic claudication. The question that I often ask the patient, hey, do you feel better when you go shopping? So when they lean forward, so if you lean forward with the stenosis, it temporarily opens up the canal just a little bit more. So people can walk longer distance. So they say, oh, yeah, when I go grocery shopping, I feel like I can walk longer. But by the time they stand up and extend and stand upright, that closes the canal just a little bit more, and in which case can send a pseudo-claudication or neurogenic claudication pain where they have a terrible pain down the legs.
Let's go over the surgeries you guys do to kind of deal with all of this. We talked about disc surgery, but there's something called a laminectomy, right? There's something called effusion. What's happening in these circumstances? When do you do that?
Yeah, sure. And I think oftentimes what's difficult about spine pathology and spine treatments, Kendall, is that they're so heterogeneous. One postoperative spine patient may talk to another one and they had a different problem and they also had a different surgery, but they're talking about, yeah, I had surgery on my low back and it seems like that should be similar, but oftentimes it is not. We'll use terms like laminectomy or laminotomy, and typically what those mean is the bone that we're taking away. So in my mind, there's decompression surgery, meaning we're taking structures away, such as the lamina. And then there's fusion surgery, and typically fusion surgery is done either for instability, meaning bones are shifting out of place. It's done for deformity, so to correct something, or it's done to stabilize an otherwise traumatic event. And I think oftentimes the connotation of fusion surgery, especially from the layperson, stems from fusion surgery that was done historically for back pain. And I can tell you, 9 times out of 10, that is not a great treatment option. So really, when John and I are talking about fusion surgery, the implications behind that, we certainly appreciate. And if for some reason instability or a bone shifting out of place is causing stenosis or narrowing, by simply taking off the lamina, we're not going to treat the underlying issue or the instability. So in a case like that, you might have to do something like a laminectomy where you decompress those neural elements, but then also fuse those bones together to prevent that instability from progressing.
When you open the lamina to give more space, right? Do you just leave it open? And does that create instability itself?
In a stable spine, yes. So when you do a laminectomy, so the lamina themselves, although it does provide some structural stability, there's a biomechanical studies that in the lumbar spine, the posterior element, meaning the supra, infra, inner spinous ligament, plus the lamina and the spinous process, provides about 20% of the stability. And the cervical spine is a little bit higher because the facet joint is not as big. So yes, there is an element of what's called a laminectomy kyphosis, post-laminectomy kyphosis that happens over time because those structures do provide some level of stability. Now, but if we're doing the surgery in a 60-year-old that doesn't have a bone shifting, there's no signs of instability, then we typically don't do instrumented fusion because they don't really have their other facet joint than their muscles are compensating. That so by taking away that sort of offending hypertrophy ligament, we're decompressing the nerve, but we're sort of relying on that the rest of the facet joint that's left behind to provide the stability for them for the rest of their lives. Now, if people live up to 120 or 130, yes, I mean, you could see that in patients who have a laminectomy, if they live long enough, at some point, they can develop instability where they were perfectly, the bones are stacked on top of each other, but then maybe 10 years, 20 years down the line, the bones can start to shift. But yeah, right now, we don't put any other devices, anything like that, in place of laminectomy.
You know, I think the further we advance within our field, the more we're understanding that preservation of the posterior soft tissues is important. And we do have these studies that indicate we can remove up to a certain amount of bone and things remain stable, or we can take down certain ligamentous structures. But I think that the further we look into it, the more we're understanding that truly the preservation, and John kind of hit on this with his discussion about minimally invasive surgery, but the preservation of native soft tissues is very important. And the more that we can help to mitigate the removal of these, I think that the better we can do in terms of stopping things like quote unquote adjacent segment disease. And I know that's something that a lot of patients seem to really understand when they say, hey, you're going to fuse this level. What is that going to do to the other levels in my back? And I think it's a very thoughtful question. And again, we're probably just at the onset of understanding how we're going to mitigate that in the future. And hopefully it's not with fusion surgery, but we have realized that again, doing things like multi-level open laminectomies may lead to other issues down the line. And so I think we're trying to be a bit more thoughtful in terms of preserving patients' own anatomy. But that's a question I get all the time, John, is you're going to do what? You're going to take off these bones in the back and you're not going to put anything in place of them? Especially we get that in the neck as well pretty often.
So I want to kind of circle back here and now focus, now that we've sort of gone over the pathology and what's happening in the surgeries, kind of go back and say, okay, patients are coming in to see you. Let me just share with you how I think of back pain. I think of three, maybe four categories. One is the person like me who was picking up a candy wrapper and threw my back out. And a couple of days later, it was feeling better and it was stiff. That's a ligamentous muscle issue. Then you have the radiculopathy patients, the sciatica patient. They got pain going down the leg. That's pretty straightforward. Then you have the patients that are sort of the chronically arthritic back, combination of sort of chronic disc degeneration, maybe facet joint degeneration. These are the folks you said that you never know exactly what's causing the pain. And then the fourth category for me, and you guys can add on the other categories, are the spinal stenosis patients, right? The ones who probably have a chronically arthritic back, but actually have a symptom that is more specific, I suppose, than just pain, where they're really getting claudication symptoms, meaning they're showing signs that their spinal cord is being impinged by this degenerative process. Are those kind of the four categories you guys use as well?
Kendall, I mean, I think you, do you run a spine clinic on the side or something like that? I mean, that's exactly, I mean, I couldn't agree more with the four categories, but I'll add now with the recent opioid pandemics, we have a lot of, and we can't ignore this either. There's a huge population of patients who've been exposed to opioids, and they may have what you just said, one through four. So these are the people that have imaging that's, maybe they have herniated disc, maybe they have stenosis, maybe they're arthritic, but on top of that, they are sort of a dependent on opioid. And these are the, some of the hardest patients to treat, because even if you treat the underlying pathology like herniated disc and stenosis and arthritis, their pain is not resolved because they have opioid dependency. And I think that category of patients really, in the last few years, has really grown in size and sort of proportion of my population that I see. Also, if I add in a sixth category, I think Dave also mentioned there are people who also develop degenerative scoliosis. So these are the people that have sort of incremental degeneration of their discs throughout the spine. So not just involving a one level, and then that really starts to affect their alignment. So as Dave said, our job of the spine is to keep the head upright in the center of the body, but they're shifted either forward or on the side. On both of them, they may have their head may be shifted forward and off to the side. And these patients are very tough to treat with the medicines and conservative therapy, and they represent a separate category of the patients. And I don't know, Dave, do you have anything more?
No, honestly, I think that's great. When we think about spine patients, oftentimes we loop them into baskets. And there's also a lot of crossover between those groups. You know, someone can have neurogenic claudication because they have spinal stenosis, but they may also have a component of axial back pain associated with a disc. And I think it's important when we start getting into the depths of surgery that we're critical with what we feel we can treat and can't. And that patient often will talk about, our goals of surgery are to help your leg pain and help your leg weakness, but I can't promise you that your back pain is going to be any better. It's definitely something where our pathologies often can overlap, but it makes for a confusing picture, especially when we're trying to communicate effectively with patients.
So the two of you have both, I think in your respective spheres, aimed to do sort of the cutting edge stuff. John, I knew you as the minimally invasive neurosurgeon at Penn. Dave, you're involved in all the research. What is the cutting edge here? I mean, with everything we talked about in terms of laminectomies and fusions, those surgeries have been done for maybe 50 years, maybe longer. But what's the cutting edge? What's happening that we should all know about?
Dave kind of mentioned, I think, honestly, we're sitting here because we're quote unquote experts in spine, but we honestly do not know a lot about the spine, starting with how to diagnose it, how to treat the best. I think a lot of these things we're sort of beginning to understand with the advent of the MRIs and maybe even more sophisticated imaging like SPECT scans. And these things requires a lot of research because it's not validated in a randomized controlled trials and things like that. And technology is really improving beyond the evidence generation. So Dave and I will be sitting in a meeting and we're bombarded with new techniques that are coming out almost quarterly. So I graduated residency and fellowship 6 years ago. Within the last 6 years, there's been different way to fuse a spine. There's different way to diagnose. I just met with a company that replaces the nucleus pulposus. They're doing a trial in Japan. And so there's all these new technologies coming up, but they haven't been really been tested and validated in a really evidence generation fashion. So I think that was kind of a long-winded question, but I think what I'm getting back at is that the spine is a little bit of uncharted territory. Even the people that has been doing this for a while, I think that sort of a laminectomy and fusion has been around for a long time, but in grand scheme of things, the spine surgery really began in the 1940s and 50s. So it hasn't been that long compared to general surgery, which has been done for over 100 years. So I think it's still in a sort of a nascent period. And I think there's a lot of like development, I think, that will happen in the future because our diagnostics will get better. I think that our interventions will become more targeted because we're going to be able to tell which patients will benefit or not benefit from the surgery. And I think that our interventions will become more minimally invasive, meaning that we will address the problem, but without destroying and everything underway. That'll be my thought. And Dave, love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, the only thing that I would add is I think we're moving in a direction, hopefully, of motion-preserving surgery. The concept of still, we fuse patients. And if you, again, extrapolate it to other joints, the idea of fusing someone's knee versus replacing it seems nuts. So I think our goal is moving in the direction of motion preservation, whether that be with replacement or other types of surgeries. And then hopefully after that, moving in the direction, instead of using metal and plastic or metal and ceramic for our replacements, moving in the direction of biologic replacements. So if we can truly engineer somebody's disc and replace a disc with a biologic disc, I think that's pretty far down the line, but I foresee that being the direction things are going. Also, to a certain degree, John, I'm sure you've seen this, is, you know, incorporating artificial intelligence into some of our decision making, whether it's from alignment perspectives or those types of things. But I think we're still trying to accrue enough data points where we can really utilize that.
You know, I think there's a part B of this discussion that we could do that focuses on some of the non-surgical therapies. But I wanted to start here with you guys, because it's important for us, I think, as internists and primary care physicians and family practitioners, to understand sort of what's the end of the road look like for the patients we see, where could they end up? And then we can sort of build in what's in between in terms of the other things. But this is an area of medicine I don't think that most of us understand that well. So I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Thanks for inviting, Kendall. This has been fun, and thank you for giving us opportunity to talk about this.
Oh, let me ask you another question, and this may be a little bit sensitive, but does it matter who we send patients to, John? I mean, you're a neurosurgeon. Dave, you're an orthopedist. You guys obviously are very collaborative. Does it matter how we do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's two ways to become a spine surgeon is go through the orthopedic training and then do a fellowship and you can become a spine surgeon. You can go the neurosurgery route and then do a fellowship and become a spine surgeon. So in the beginning, I think this is a little bit of vestige of the past where neurosurgeons typically were focused on the brain and then the sort of a spine was a secondary thing they used to do because, you know, oh, it's a lumbar disc, take it out, right? And that's how the neurosurgeons used to do all the decompression, and then the orthopedics will come in and do instrumentation. And then the intradural, like the tumors and things were left for the neurosurgeons, and the orthopedics did more of a scoliosis. And that was really of the past. Now the training of the neurosurgeon and orthopedic surgeon, there's so much crossover once you get to the fellowship level. And once you get out into coming out in practice, in reality, Dave and I see the same people, a similar patient population. Once you're out in the community, whether you come from the neurosurgery background or orthopedic background, I think all of us are sort of trained the similar way. Now, I will say that the orthopedics do have an advantage in terms of understanding the hip pathology and knee pathology, which are often comorbid, and then the shoulder pathology with the neck. So the orthopedic training do prepare you to consider other joints. And that's how I always, in my training, I always try to spend time with orthopedic guys because I wanted to pick their brain, and they have an understanding of the bony anatomy and bone fusions knowledge was, I thought, was always very good to learn from.
John hit the nail on the head. Historically, there may have been some differences, and I think we're very fortunate here that we're so collaborative. You know, we have a multidisciplinary conference where John and I are lucky. We get together as spine surgeons and we talk cases, and I think that's a fortunate aspect of being here. My fellowship, and John, I'm sure similar at yours, the fellowship I did was at Cleveland Clinic, and there were two neurosurgery residents and three orthopedic residents, and we all did the same fellowship and had the same training. But I do think from the current landscape today, things have melded together. I will tell you, if I have a terrible intradural tumor, John, I'm still calling for your help, though.
That was a great discussion. I really appreciate you guys coming on. I'll send up a follow-up email and find out if you're the folks to bring back for a discussion of the non-surgical therapies, and we could kind of work through that, because I want to go through that as well. But it was really helpful to hear how this all fits together from your perspective. It's kind of a black box for us, so it's really helpful. So thank you to Dr. Yoon and Dr. Casper for joining the Penn Primary Care Podcast. Thank the audience for being here, and please join us again next time.
Please note that this podcast is for educational purposes only. For specific questions, please contact your physician, and if an emergency, please call 911 or go to the nearest emergency department.